So I'm sat in the English faculty at the University of Oxford with Professor Elika Burma, writer and critic, and we're here today to talk about Elika's most recent novel, The Shouting in the Dark, which is published by Sandstone Press in 2015 and has just been re-released this year, 2019, in ebook form, this time with the addition of four short autobiographical sketches and a further interview about the novel. This is a particularly apt and happy week to be discussing The Shouting in the Dark because it has just been announced as the winner of this year's Olive Schreiner Prize. So congratulations.
Thank you. Absolutely over the moon.
I thought just to get us started, perhaps you could provide us with a sort of plot summary or some key characters and themes of The Shouting in the Dark.
Well, it's a father and daughter story, which is set in South Africa in the 1970s under apartheid. And it is a story of growing up, the daughter's growing up, and her both growing away from, and yet in some subtle ways towards, her father, or a clearer understanding of her father, who is a war veteran, a Second World War veteran. He's an older father relative to some of Ella, the daughter's peers, and he has this record of having served in the British Eastern Fleet in the Eastern Indian Ocean around what was then the Dutch East Indies, now Indonesia, and the North Australian coast in the later years of the Second World War. And without giving too much away, he is still, so many years on from that time, he is still, it becomes clearer and clearer to Ella, the daughter, he is still coming to terms with those experiences. Although he doesn't have the vocabulary for understanding what's going on with him, and nor does she, it's clear that he's coping with some sort of post-traumatic stress and distress. And one of the ways in which he tries to express that or to suppress it is through drinking. He self-medicates with alcohol. Those are the bare bones.
So I'm thinking about what you've just said about Ella and her dad, who are definitely at the core of the story. And I had this feeling, after rereading the novel again this summer, that they both are forced to live in between spaces, because you open with an image of Ella hiding in some hydrangea bushes, and then later in the early chapters she crawls in the crawl space under the house. So even on the homestead they inhabit literal in between spaces, and then more socially and more metaphorically they are forced into increasingly impossible positions. And I wondered if you could talk a bit more about what kind of lives are lived in this novel, and how they're lived, and what spaces and maybe what routes they take as they do.
What a good question. Just thinking about it quite quickly as you were talking, I was reminded how very many in-between spaces the two main characters occupy. I mean, they are both of them transitional on multiple levels, transitional temporally in the sense that there's a lot of change that's going on, and transitional also in relation to each other, as they never really settle into comfortable positions or roles relative to each other. And for me, it's probably all of it epitomized with the placement of the two, Ella and her father, who's called Har, H-A-R. It's epitomized in their placement around the veranda, which is, supremely an interstitial space of colonial dwellings, neither quite inside nor outside, neither dark nor light, neither neither, if you like, master or servant, a place of exchange and transition and in betweenness, and not being quite settled, even though, of course, it's, you know, to sit on a veranda lounging and looking out across one's lands is, of course, quintessentially a colonial settler image. So there's that, and that, of course, also reminds me of the fact that Ella, squeezing herself or kind of, you know, worming her way between the window and the curtain, spies on her father at night while he's sitting on the veranda, slapping at mosquitoes and telling himself stories and having a drink or 10. Other examples come to mind. Ella and her mother kind of moving between Africa, Southern Africa, and Europe back and forth as the mother tries to work out where she actually wants to base herself, kind of walks and journeys and kind of corridors and passageways. Yes, there are any number of examples we could mention.
But it's interesting hearing you respond with such detail and obviously such knowledge as author to that one question, because you've teased out so many themes. All of these are raised and explored in very different ways in the four sketches that you've now added mm-hmm. to The Shouting in the Dark. And they really add not an alternative, but a different pivotal position from which to explore those same themes. So that seems like a good time to ask you, why add these four sketches? What have they added for you? What have they allowed you to do as a writer?
The addition of the four sketches plus the interview with Meg Samuelson, which focuses in part on The Shouting in the Dark and in part on Indian Arrivals, which is another book, a monograph that I produced around the same time, but also about journeys and arrivals and departures and migration. The focus and, in fact, the existence of those sketches have everything to do with the fact that an Australian publisher was interested in bringing out The Shouting in the Dark. Their interest came about in part because one or two Australian readers had spotted that the unravelling of The Shouting in the Dark, the final moments, which I'm not going to reveal to the listener because, of course, we want to tempt people to read the book, but the final moments, the unravelling, take place in Australia and in close to Darwin, in Darwin to be precise. And what that then does is casts a light, as these readers pointed out to me, casts a light back across the book, in that we then see that the story that we've been reading traces a kind of an arc of geographical kind of belonging, transnational awareness that extends all the way, depending which direction you want to trace, all the way from Darwin through Dutch East Indies, Singapore, India, Indian Ocean, African continent, Rift Valley, all the way back to Southern Africa, or we could trace in the other direction. And when that became apparent to me through these readers, it's always amazing what readers can kind of show you about your own work that you thought, you know, you were very familiar with. What that showed was that the novel had started to navigate terrain that I've since 2015, when it first came out, become incredibly interested in as both a reader and a writer, and also as somebody interested in colonial history. I have become very interested in stories of and histories of travel and linkage across the Southern Hemisphere. And, you know, it's like that thing that George Eliot says about the scratched metal surface, that through the way the light falls suddenly reveals to you a new pattern in the scratches. Suddenly seeing the work in that context as this kind of, you know, inadvertent map showed me that a number of experiences in my own life, my life as a traveller, my life as a reader, my life as an admirer of the work of Catherine Mansfield, had also similarly started to map, trace southern connections. So, talking to the University of Western Australia Press about the possibility of an Australian edition, it became very clear that there was potential for my starting to demonstrate through putting the novel, this one Southern Compass, together with some short autobiographical sketches. It was a complete joy to put those sketches together. In fact, I have a few more, and I think what I will ultimately do is you know, gather about 12 of them and put them together as a book to be published here.
Mm. So with all that in mind, I was thinking of a specific example. I'm having to check the title of the story I want to ask you about the sketch. It's called The Other Side of the World and A Piece of Home, which is, I think, the third sketch in this new edition of Shouting in the Dark, because it tells this specific and very humorous story from your past about travelling from England to Australia with a small child and stopping as you do in Singapore on the flight. It allows you to, the quote is, beat a pathway back to your own experiences as a child and a young woman. So that sense of touching base in a space that one of your parents had once lived and worked in Singapore. And I just wondered about what made you return to those specific moments, because it's not just one moment in time you're returning to there. It's multiple layers. It's you and your baby son looking out of the airport window. It's your father working at that moment in time. It's presumably also looking back to the descriptions of Singapore and Shouting in the Dark. So what's happening in that moment and in that story?
Well, what I remember being incredibly aware of in that moment of looking out of the windows myself with baby son was, it's very numinous and mystical in a way, as these things are, but something about the layerings of time, you know, how we physically only inhabit one moment in time, but through memory we can inhabit different moments in time. This is what is so, it's so incredibly, you know, interesting and difficult to pin down about memory. And what's so tragic about when individuals die, because, you know, those memories go. We can't transfer as yet the films, you know, the films of memory in our minds. So I remember, you know, being completely bowled over in that moment of arrival in Singapore and looking out and seeing the orchids and the lushness and the very, very neat motorways, and some of the colonial buildings, though very, very few survive. You know, just being aware of the presentness of the past, because of stories I had heard, because of pictures I had seen or not seen. You know, looking back at those moments, what really strikes you is that life writing is able to give a kind of, you know, a 3D effect to those, if you like, the, you know, the interleaving of different moments in the past in our memories.
I feel I have to ask a question then about movement between what people sometimes think of as very discrete literary genres, because in this new edition, it's not provocative isn't the right word, but this is quite a challenging idea that you read a novel, that you read an interview about your intent in the novel, and then you read four autobiographical sketches. It's a challenge to the reader not to conflate them all, to see them all as the same thing, but to understand that you're inhabiting different roles in a single text there. And I'm asking this because you're also the director for the Oxford Centre for Life Writing. So as a kind of final question, are you tempted to write something that could be described as a full-length memoir? Is this perhaps the closest that you might come, or that you might be tempted to come to life writing as someone who has studied it and published on it from an academic perspective?
It's a difficult question. I fall over backwards mentally at the idea of the graft of it, because, you know, I would have to go back to documents and letters, and the idea is overwhelming. I need to raise some funding for a research assistant to help me, which suggests also that it's not something that hasn't occurred to me, but I've always thought to myself, definitely not yet. So many other things to write, so many other things to do, so many more decades of life to live. But if I look at some of the, especially the women writers that I deeply admire, Doris Lessing being one, and think about how they started to, you know, write their experiences and their lives, I am very intrigued. I'm sort of teased by the idea. But just at the minute, you know that the idea of the graft of it is overwhelming. That's another sort of sign that I do take life writing very seriously, and I'm very, you know, interested in the whole practice of it. And, you know, I'm interested in the fact that, you know, a number of my colleagues have been venturing into this terrain themselves, you know, and they are, you know, younger than I am. So, and they've both written, the two that I'm thinking of, there may be others, they've both written, you know, really great books, in which they have been asking all these difficult questions about, you know, how much is fictional, how do we narrate memory, you know, does the excavation of memory, you know, raise ghosts who can't then be kind of put back in the box? Does life writing help us make sense of where we stand in relation to others or to our pasts? You know, I think they've done so, and others we could mention have done so really, really compellingly. So, you know, it is an intriguing prospect stroke project for some point in the future, given world enough and time.
Thank you for such a considered and quite diplomatic answer to a bit of an unfair question on the spot, but that's fascinating to hear. That seems like also a great point with the idea of who knows about future projects to bring this one conversation to a close. And thank you for talking through this latest edition with me. Congratulations again on the recent Olive Schreiner Prize. We'll close it there.
Thanks, Emma. Thanks.